We're very pleased to have with us Reverend Walter Tejan, who is the president of the California Nevada Hawaii District of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. He is an alumnus of this institution, graduating in 1961. He served as pastor and mission developer in Cranbrook and Kimberley, British Columbia, following graduation. He also served as a parish pastor at Zion Lutheran in Glendale, California, and Our Savior Lutheran in Sacramento, California. In 1983, the California-Nevada-Hawaii District asked him to serve as Director of Parish Services, a position he held until his election as District President in 1991. He is married to Ione, a Lutheran school teacher, and they have four children, and he wanted me to make sure and get this in, also four grandchildren. So we welcome into our midst President Tejan.
Well, I do thank you very much. Because of a little pastoral situation, I've been making a few trips to a valley town in our district, and I stopped in on every occasion to see my father, who's in a skilled nursing center, and I kept saying, well, I was here for a meeting, and I thought I'd stop in and say hello. And then the last time I saw him, I said, I'm coming to St. Louis for a few days, and he said, you know, if you'd study harder, you wouldn't have to go to so many meetings. So I don't know what that means, but I'm really happy to be here, and I thank you for the invitation. What I propose to do in the time that we have is help you to kind of look through my eyes at ministry within the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, California, Nevada, Hawaii District. Just a brief look at the history, where we are today, and then kind of a grocery list of what I believe some of the issues are which all of us will be facing together. And then finally, a few comments to you as future pastors in the church, what I and I think other district presidents might be looking to you for, and the kinds of encouragement that we want to give you. So, if you would just kind of turn the calendar back a little bit to the year 1850. I don't know if you are you able to see that? It's not going to get any bigger, so if you can't see it, forget it. I thought it might be good to look at something up in the screen there. The lure of gold attracted people to California. There's a very interesting dialogue between Dr. Walter and some people. Actually, it's not Dr. Walter is reporting this. It's a dialogue between a pastor and some people who wanted to move to California following the call of gold, and all kinds of, why do you want to go out there? God can take care of you here. You're putting God to the test, and on and on and on. But the people did come out in the year 1850 and following. At that time, the total California population was 90,000. Today, we're over 30 million. San Francisco totaled 35,000 people. Oakland, California, across the bay, there were no ferries, there was no bridge, 1,500 people. And Sacramento, the capital of the state of California, totaled 7,000 people, and the surrounding environs there are reaching up toward 750,000 to a million today. At that same time, across the hills in the state of Nevada, Virginia City, which you may know from old days video bonanza, 40,000 people working the gold mines, and of course that's really what gave rise to cities like Sacramento and San Francisco. The city of San Francisco, I don't know what your perception of San Francisco is today, but if you're depending on the news media, I guarantee you that you're wrong. And if you're not wrong, at least your perception is no different than what was reported back in the years 1850, 1860. Dr. Beeler, Jacob Matthias Beeler, the first one to be sitting where some of you fourth-year students are, in a much smaller seminary, was visited by the seminary president, who suggested, because he could speak German and also speak English, he might be interested in going out to California. And he accepted. By the way, he was never ordained, but he served out there for many years. He was the first president of the then California Oregon district. This is the city, the description of the city that he was called to. 1860. The city swarmed with murderers, thieves, burglars, gamblers, prostitutes, and swindlers of every kind. All this was accompanied by the gurgle of vast quantities of hard liquor, the consumption of which probably reached its peak in 1890. In that year, there was one saloon for every 96 inhabitants, and there were, in addition, at least 2,000 unlicensed bars. Little history. First service in San Francisco, under the leadership of Dr. Beeler, had 28 in attendance. And I'm sure you know from your study of history, because I believe this was a very common paradigm, and in some cases we still think that way today, we look for the German Lutherans. And so Dr. Beeler did too, and sometimes we say that critically. I don't think we should. Actually, these were God's redeemed people, and they were in need of nurturing, and so obviously that was a place for us to begin. 28 people in the worship attendance at that time, and it was suggested that there was a potential in the city of San Francisco of about 1,600 German prospects. That's the language that was used. Now, I want you to keep that in mind, because I'm going to be relating to that in just a few moments as we look at San Francisco today. 1881, and this still staggers me. At St. Paulus Lutheran Church, the Sunday school, in the year 1881, totaled 562. 562. In 1887, it shot up to 800. Now, I have to tell you, I approach those figures as a skeptic. And a sainted professor that I had at California Concordia College had done all of the research on that, and he's always very accurate, but like I said, I just don't know where they put the children. But anyhow, that was a sizable Sunday school. In fact, he suggested that at St. Paulus Lutheran Church, which, by the way, is no longer part of the Missouri Synod, the first congregation on the West Coast is where the first Lutheran Sunday school was born in the United States. Again, that's based on the research that he has done. I think if you talk with some people a little bit later in the English district, they might have some question about that, but that was his understanding. So, where are we today? Well, when we began to organize out there, as I already indicated, it was the California Oregon district. We had the district made up everything from Washington all the way down to Southern California. Then about the turn of the century, Oregon and Washington formed what is today the Northwest District, and about the time of the Depression, the 1930s, the Southern California District was born. And today, the California-Nevada-Hawaii District encompasses, you can see, about two-thirds of the state of California. North of Bakersfield, we have Hawaii, and we have all of Nevada except Las Vegas. Now, I put this map on there for a reason, and that is ever since Southern California changed its name from Southern California District to the Pacific Southwest District, we have been getting all of their mail. So I want you to know that there are two districts in California. One is Pacific Southwest, and then there is the one that has the name California in it. Las Vegas, we used to have that as part of our responsibility, but we discovered that at creation, when God had finished, He reached down into the what is now the northern part of California, reached up, and everything loose rolled south, and that included Las Vegas. So we had to make a decision. When Synod came and said, we've got this foreign station over in Hawaii, what do you think? Do you want Las Vegas or Hawaii? So we sacrificed, and today we've got 8 congregations on 3 islands in the state of Hawaii, and depending on what happens at the International Lutheran Women's Missionary League this summer, we've asked for a grant. We may be starting or turning a preaching station into a regular mission on the island of Hawaii. Within the city of San Francisco, maybe I could back up. I shared some of shared this with some of you in one or two classes that I visited. About 3 years ago, Moish Rosen, who is the executive director for Jews for Jesus, asked me, he invited my predecessor, Dr. Orville Oswald, and me for lunch. And as we were driving over, we thought, well, he's going to ask us for money or something like that, trying to anticipate what was behind the lunch. And here he comes in. There were 5 of us in the room. He's a very large man. He knows food. We had a buffet. I've never seen a buffet like that. I mean, he's a gourmet individual. And while he was still standing, before any exchange in conversation, he said, what are you going to do about evangelism in the city of San Francisco? Well, Dr. Oswald is a man with a very sharp mind and a very quick response, and so he said, well, that's Walt's area. He can take care of that. And I cannot tell you what I said. I know I mumbled through something, and he said, fine, that we can pray about that. And with that, he invited us to sit down, and we had a prayer for the lunch. And then he went on to say, do you know, now this is 3 years ago, do you know if you took the whole community, the whole Lutheran community, all synods in the city of San Francisco, and put them together for one gathering, you would have about 1,500 people in a city of 750,000. Now again, keep in mind the figures that I quoted before about Sunday school, about the number of German Lutheran prospects in the year 1860 and following, and so on. So that got me doing a little thinking, and I looked at the San Francisco circuit, across the bay to the Oakland circuit, and the East Bay circuit, which again would be across the bay from San Francisco, but a little farther north. And I looked at 24 congregations which were there in the year 1970, which happens to be the first year that our synod included average worship attendance in their statistics. And I looked at what the average attendance was for the combination of those 24 congregations, and it came out 4,000, just about 5,000 people. Today, those same congregations have an average attendance of about 2,800 people. What's happening? And I have to say, when I proclaimed the word this morning, that was not just for you, that was for me too, because it's kind of humbling to sit out there and what in all the world are we going to do? What has happened? Well, I think we can cite some of the things that have taken place. One, certainly all of society has changed. We go back to the suburbs that were planted in the 50s and 60s, and by the way, we really went bonkers in the year 1950, from 1950 to 1965. We started one-third of the congregations in existence in the California, Nevada, Hawaii district. And today, many of those are very, very small congregations. And if you study what happened, we were going after the Lutheran people who were moving to these new suburbs. We would get them together. We would start a congregation. And things would just mushroom. We had Families for Christ, Mission, PTRs, preaching, teaching, reaching. I'm suddenly realizing as I use some of those things that I'm a little older and some here may not even know what I'm talking about. But anyhow, we had lots of evangelistic activity. And then, as people became more affluent, they moved from their homes that had about 1,100 square feet, 1,200 square feet, no family room, space heater. They would move out to a newer suburb, and many of them kept their membership in the congregation here. Other people then would move in and occupy the houses they left. So now you've got these people coming to church and going home, coming to church, going home, and the people here do not have an opportunity to interact with those who were part of the neighborhood community from the 50s to the 65s, to 65. So I personally believe that is one key issue that is affecting us, and it's probably not only our district. The whole Vietnam issue in our district, unfortunately, we did lose a number of congregations during the whole synodical conflict, but I think we lost more than that. We lost our mission drive. We lost our mission drive. And I want to add a postscript right here, because if the candidates who have come into our district in the last 3 years are any indication of our future, I'm excited, because I see among some of our younger pastors people, by the grace of God, recapturing some of that mission drive, that willingness to risk, that willingness to fail, because we know we live under the forgiveness of a gracious God through His Son, Jesus Christ. So anyhow, things are, you know, in terms of mission and that, are a little rocky in our district, and yet there's so many good things that are happening. I want to then just identify for you what I consider to be some of the needs, some of the challenges, I should say. First of all, the needs. Make no mistake about it. In our district, in one sense, the needs are no different than in every other district of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Throughout the world, the need is for the proclamation of law and the pronouncement of the gospel. People are so caught up in busyness, and yet in their busyness, there's a lot of loneliness, a lot of separation, a lot of brokenness. And personally, I don't believe the church in many cases is responding. And so when I use that term, well, we've really got to relate to their needs, I'm not talking about some kind of manipulation to get people into the church, but rather I'm talking about eyes that see people who are hurting, and yet eyes that have been given new vision, a vision filled with hope because of the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. The second thing I believe challenge facing us, and personally the whole Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, is we have to move from rest area to mission. And I want to spend a little bit of time on that, because I think it's so very important. How many of you think there's something wrong with a rest area? You're right. Oh, there's one that thought there was something wrong with a rest area. I personally do not. They are gifts. When you're traveling down the freeway and all of a sudden you realize that your bladder may not last until the next service station. Or maybe 2 o'clock in the morning and you're trying to make it home and the eyes are getting a little heavy. And then you see that sign, rest area. How many of us, though, would think about a rest area in this way? Let's plan to build a rest area. And so we do. And then we make it our purpose to bring as many people as we can into the rest area. And once we get in the rest area, we sit around and we say, now where are we going to put the bathrooms? And so we make that big decision. And where are we going to put the pet areas? And where are we going to put the picnic benches? And what about the autos and the truck traffic? Where's the parking places? Where will these be? And on and on and on. Now, periodically, we do get over in the truck area and we ask how things are out on the freeway. And they tell us, and then we go back to our business. And pretty soon, some people begin to leave the rest area for other rest areas. And we sit around and we look at ourselves and we say, oh my, we're losing people from our rest area. If we don't get some more people in our rest area, we're not going to have anybody to take care of the bathrooms and the picnic area and the pet areas and on and on and on. Well, I see that as a picture of the church. You see, freeways were not made for rest areas. Rest areas were made for the freeways. I think that's something like what Jesus says concerning the Sabbath. And I believe that is a challenge that we have to face. We get out on the freeway and we begin to recognize what our standing is by nature before God, and it's awful nice to see that rest area sign ahead where we again come under the umbrella of His grace in word and sacrament. And then it's back out under the freeway again where we find stranded motorists and hitchhikers and homeless people. And that's work, folks. And I don't think it's work that can be accomplished just by money alone. It takes risks of getting out to where the people are. And again, you can get tired doing that. And then comes that welcome sign, rest area. And the Lord provides. And His Spirit drives us out onto the freeway again. That is what I see the primary challenge for the congregations and ministries of the California Nevada Hawaii District and also the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I believe we also have to learn how better to involve ourselves in seed planting ministries. I think we probably do reasonably well with harvesting ministries. But how able are we and how patient are we when it comes to seed planting? God willing, next Sunday, I'm going to be at one of our downtown Oakland congregations for the 90th anniversary of First Trinity Oakland. And the pastor there, in my opinion, is a hard worker. He's had a lot of experience in inner city. But every once in a while, I'll get a telephone call. Can we have lunch? And the guy is so down, because he does not see any produce of people increasing in number occupying the pews on Sunday morning. And my response, and I play this over and over again, is, have you ever thought about your ministry as seed planting? Do you believe what the Scriptures say when it tells us that the Word of God will not return void? I mean, you and I may not live long enough to see the harvest, but that doesn't make your ministry any less important. Seed planting ministries. I read a book a couple of years ago that had to do with cross-cultural ministry. Thought it was an area where I needed help, and the author threw me a curve because he talked about cross-cultural ministry beginning with God. That God crossed from His culture into our culture for our sake, and he says that's where all ministry begins. And then he went on to say something rather startling. He says, forget about the many different ethnic groupings just for a moment and consider this. among the Anglo communities in the United States of America, we are well toward the latter half of the second generation of people who have never understood the meaning of Jesus. And the only way to address that is by planting seed. You are not going to be able to harvest because there's nothing there to harvest. And seed planting involves one-on-one. It involves relational type ministries. It involves caring. It involves putting people first because God Himself has put people like you and me first on His agenda. Seed planting ministries, an extremely large challenge facing us. The next ones I'm not going to spend a lot of time on. Financial support. I think we all know what's happening in our church body, in our districts. One thing I will say, and I'm not going to comment any further on this, I just want to throw it out because some of you, I pray, will never be a part of something that I fear could happen in our church body 10, 15 years down the road. And that is that we begin fighting over money. Because unless I am totally wrong, and I truly hope I am, the way we are going, I can see in about 10 years we will become a very wealthy church with no people. And that would produce a whole new set of problems as we start arguing over where are the dollars going to go. I am so grateful, and I'm not saying this critically, I'm so grateful for the people, the ministering agents we have with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Foundation. We have one planned giving director in our district, a close personal friend. He and I talk about this a lot. He shared with our staff last week that in 1992, the total bequests for future ministry in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod exceeded $100 million. And since 1983, when this began, to the present, we are beyond $600 million. And these funds, as the Lord takes people home and the people who have given these requests are some of our finest Christian people who want to serve the Lord, and they recognize the resources they have been given them by Him, and now they want to use those in ministry. All I'm saying is, if that happens, I hope and pray that the Spirit of God will lead you, who will be the leaders of the church, to keep the focus on the cross and on the servant role, and always remember that finances are a resource. They are never to divide us, never to separate us. End of commentary. Just a concern that I have. Different models for ministry. I'm going to give you one that we're looking at. I don't know if this is even going to develop. But we're finding developers and communities won't set aside property for churches anymore. Communities are not happy to see churches built because it impacts the tax rolls. When I lived in Sacramento, our next door neighbor, a former Baptist minister, he would tell me on a regular basis how great it was to live just a few doors from the church. Church helps the neighborhood, church increases property values, and all of that. Not so anymore. Today, in many communities, the church is considered a liability. So, north of Eva Beach in Hawaii, we're looking to possibly relocate Messiah Lutheran Church and its school, and we're looking at a whole new development, an upscale development, planned by the Campbell Corporation, who will not give us a piece of property, but they will sell us a piece of property if maybe we would consider a church mall. where we would put in a building that would have a number of buildings, so the Baptist Christians, the Presbyterian Christians, the Roman Catholic Christians, and the Lutheran Christians would all have their own stores, can we say that, but in a mall. Now, I don't know. I think, well, that's certainly a different model. I can also see some problems with that too, particularly when you find yourself in a landlord situation with maybe another Christian group that doesn't want to pay its bills. So these are some of the creative things that we're really having to look at. Inner city, possibly having one or two congregations saying, God gave us these resources for a time. Now we're seeing that time has concluded. We're going to sell everything and we're going to put our resources into an endowment and call mission developers to work in the inner cities and maybe out of homes and storefronts. But we're going to keep this larger facility over here because on high feast days, Christmas, Easter, Pentecost, Ascension, all of these small churches in the community will gather for the big community celebration of thanksgiving and praise at the, quote, cathedral. Just some different ways of looking at ministry, which we are being forced to do today. Then, finally, the context for ministry in which we're finding ourselves, certainly on the West Coast, although I believe this is certainly growing as a national issue, a high degree of individualism and secularism, just not a real strong sense of community. Kind of a what am I going to get out of it, and that translates over to congregations that are calling pastors, and we find what has been termed a hire and fire mentality. Those are things that we're dealing with all the time. And then finally, the need for a servant attitude. And brothers, if you don't hear anything else today, I hope you can hear this. I heard from all over our district, and maybe some of you caught this, but you didn't make a connection. I don't happen to read Dear Abby, but I did get a number of clippings in the mail because the pastor who is quoted happens to be one of our district pastors. Dear Abby, I have written this. I have been saving this piece written by Reverend Milton Shem, pastor of Emmanuel Lutheran Church of Fresno, and think perhaps your readers would appreciate it. It appeared in our church bulletin some time ago, but words of wisdom are timeless, right? Then, here's the article. A need for love and humility. The chemical contents of the same bottle of medicine can bring the bloom of health to the cheeks of one person or the power of death to the cheeks of another, depending on how properly it is used. The electrical current in a high-tension wire can send the soul of one person to eternity or can make the wheels of industry hum, depending on the manner in which it is used. A razor-like knife in the hand of a madman can take a life, but that same knife in the hand of a skilled surgeon can save a life. The power and influence of a clergyman on the lives of his people can be misused and abused in the same way. It is so easy for the clergy to be judgmental and legalistic. My seminary aptly taught us dogmatics, homiletics, and exegesis, but did not prepare us so well in dealing with our people. Hence, many of the clergy have failed in this area. A minister ought to be dominant, but not domineering. He ought to be exercising leadership, but not lordship. Humility is one of the basic qualities for a clergyman, along with large amounts of love and concern for people. A minister ought to be less legalistic and more loving in his dealing with people. I hope I have learned this over the 35 years of my ministry. I wish the seminary would have stressed this aspect as much as it did the academics. One person's point of view, I read it because I think it's something that I want all of you who look to life in the parish ministry to hear. You will go out with authority, but your authority will be no different than mine. And it's the authority that God gives to proclaim the word, to forgive sin, to speak a word of hope in the name of Jesus Christ. And along with that, a very, very caring, patient spirit that works with people, serves people, and equips people to join with you in ministry. A servant attitude. I've got some other things that I could share with you, but I'm sensitive to the fact that time is moving on, and I did want to leave some time for questions that I just touched on some of the things facing ministry in California, Nevada, Hawaii. I focused mostly on California. I would be happy to tell you all about the diversity from California that exists in Nevada or how things are out in Hawaii, but I thought maybe it would be better at this point to stop to see if, in fact, there are any questions that some of you may have.
Thank you very much. Given that we are in the midst of curriculum review and agreeing with your sentiments and statements on that last article, how should the seminary go about trying to teach a servant's heart?
Well, I've been here now for a few days, and I say this is one message I will be taking home. I think it is happening. I think it's happening already. I see modeling being done on campus, and I'm very, very pleased about that. I'm not sure that curriculum has to become more practical. I would be very, very reluctant to see us do a lot of changing, but I do think curriculum has to be made practical. Theology has to be made practical. Theology has to be applied. And I believe in each of the disciplines, focusing on how this is applied would be very, very helpful. Other questions?
On the point of financial support and the prospect of fighting over financial support, isn't the danger perhaps even closer than 5 or 10 years in this way? When we moved away from the united budget, as I call it, it's almost as if within the church now, mission agencies and others, those get the money which have the biggest profile or make the biggest noise, I don't know how to put it. Do you see that as a problem already or a danger, or is this something that we need not fear in the future?
I guess it is a concern. I'm not sure that it's a fear. I ask myself, what is it the Lord expects us, our church, to be doing in mission? Might what He expects us to do and what He gifts us to do be in some way coordinated with the gifts that our people are giving? It may be that maybe we should be stopping in some areas. I don't know. But another side of that question has to do with the people in the congregations. I think we have to recognize that the people are already demonstrating where their heart is. And they are giving and supporting a lot of things inside the church and outside the church. And I guess this experiment in expanding the circle is kind of a look to see if, in fact, we might in some way bless that. Now, having said that, I share your concern, because I know that in our district we have some less popular ministries. For example, we have one pastor who is serving a congregation in San Francisco part-time, and he's also serving Laguna Honda Hospital, which is the largest convalescent care facility, long-term care, in the nation. I think it's 1,200 beds. It's more than that. Anyway, it's the largest in the nation. I could see something like that not generating a lot of interest, like maybe starting a new mission over in Hawaii. And so, yes, there would be a concern. I don't know any other way to go about it except to look at where the people are and in some way try to bless what they are doing and then rise with them to give them new sites in mission too, which would include both the more popular and less popular. Sometimes I smile a little bit too at when I think about expanding the circle, because and maybe I should say something more about that, because it occurs to me some people may not know what I'm talking about, but this is just really a way to give people in the pew congregations a way to designate where they want their gifts to go. And if in fact all of us have to do our own promoting in order to get dollars, I see a lot of our mail carriers with hernias bringing all of this stuff to our homes, the many, many appeals. It is a very real concern. Other questions?
Given what you said about servanthood, and given that there is this myth of a power base to control the synod, what words of wisdom do you have to share with the seminary students, especially as fourth year they get ready to go out, that we won't get caught up in this concept of power struggle, rather get caught up in the servanthood?
I don't want to make it sound simplistic, but I think that I would begin with prayer and a good devotional life, a disciplined devotional life, a life that begins each day with the prayer, Lord, as I study what you have to say today, let me see you in a new way. Direct my thoughts in the way that you would have me go. Lead me in the ministry that you would have me do. The second thing, I guess I would not be concerned about structure. I get very, very nervous when 2-3 months, and this is not just candidates, this is seasoned pastors, accept a call, come into the congregation, and the first thing they're going to do is change the constitution. Take the time it takes to change the constitution to get into homes and visit with your people. And not into their homes, many of them are working today outside the home. And so arrange, talk with your elders, see if maybe you might get a little budget item to take a few of them out to lunch. Or meet them at their place, take a sack lunch and eat with them. Find out what's going on in their life. Third possibility, I would think, is fellows and ladies, if in fact we are global Christians, the only way that vision of servanthood is going to be widened is if it begins with you. I know that our Synod, Board for Mission Services, has done a lot of preparing materials And I really don't think we need any materials. They are more than happy to share with you what they have. And I'm sure districts in which you end up have much information. But it has to be used on the local level. Over at Good Shepherd Honolulu, a congregation that's been there for a number of years, got a new pastor there. He's an older pastor, but he's new, relatively new to the congregation. If you go there today, that's probably the only thing I have a little difficulty with is worship over there, because I think that's probably the one or two congregations in our district that people might say this is a Lutheran worship service. But they are reaching more university people than our university ministry is over there. And it's all done through Bible study. A year ago now, my wife and I were over there. This congregation did not have a Lenten service on Wednesday night. They had a Bible study. We went there, and lo and behold, I'm sitting there. I felt like a grandparent of these youngsters there. The pastor and I, we were in our 50s, and everybody else is 20, 25. Two prayers were offered for individuals who were part of that group, because one couldn't be there. He was still at the dormitory. He found people that were interested in studying the Bible, and he wanted to start a group in his room, and he was asking us to pray for him. Another fellow found that the city of Honolulu had designated part of a park for the homeless, and he was out there trying to start a Bible study. So he asked us to pray for him and excused himself from the group. The point that I'm trying to make is when it does come to worship, this very modest building, which they have already outgrown, in the back has a map of the world. And the pastor uses little pieces of cotton. And every month, he emphasizes a mission. The whole month, he emphasizes a mission that we as Christians in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod are doing together. He's saying, yes, you people, you may not know it, but you're part of a larger fellowship. Well, that's the key, fellas. That's servant ministry. Being with the people, also being a good disciplined devotional life, and also elevating the eyes of people to see not only the ministry in your own community, but the worldwide picture. Which, by the way, includes colleges, seminaries, the whole picture. Anybody else?
Have you found some specific models of ministry that have proven themselves effective in dealing with the secularism and the individualism that's so prevalent today?
I don't know that it would be a particular model. I think it depends more on the type of leadership that is given. The modeling of community, the modeling of caring for others, the modeling of seeing that God gives us everything we have materially for our own use and for giving away to others. But, you know, that I think the Lord can use a number of different models in order to bring that about. I would like to conclude with what I hope will be a message of encouragement for you. And the message is simply in response to another question. And that is, what do you do when the dream dies? All of the excitement. And then the recognition that maybe 4 weeks from now, two, three, five of you might find that a call doesn't come until June or July. I promise you it will be coming. And I promise you the district presidents are going to be working in your corner. I'm still hopeful that we will have all of this taken care of by the end of April, and I know
Dr. Vogel is also hopeful of that. What do you do when the dream dies, as it did in the case of a young couple who just came to St. Luke in Santa Rosa after having been out of the teaching ministry for a while, and they are just so excited. This is their first year, and they're teaching one in the 7th and 8th grade, one in the 6th grade level, two young children, and 2-3 weeks ago discovered that the wife has breast cancer and it's a little bit more advanced than they had hoped it would. What do you do when the dream dies? St. Mark Kaneohe, another teacher couple, waiting on their first child. All of the excitement. Last week, stillborn. And I was talking with our education executive, and we were just kind of trying to imagine, neither one of us having gone through that trauma, what must it be like to go home and to see what had been planned as the nursery and nobody there to put in that little bed. And then I think of the Lord. In my Father's house are many mansions already prepared. And the fact that he too had a dream that died. But he didn't give up. He gave his son Jesus to reconcile, to renew, to recreate. And now there's rooms for all of us. Unfortunately, there are some, many, millions that continue to say no. And he too probably will have to walk into some of those rooms empty. What do you do when the dream dies? I think Paul gives us the response. He says, but we never give up. We never get discouraged. Because we know that the ministry is not ours. We know that the work is the Lord's, and that the whole plan from beginning to end, bringing all in heaven and on earth under His Lordship, that's something He has designed. And you and I and the church, well, we get to be. We have the high and holy privilege of being His instruments. You're going to have times when you feel like the dream dies. But I want to guarantee you, just as it didn't die at Calvary, for Calvary was followed by Easter Sunday, it's not going to die for you either, or for me, until the Lord says, welcome home. Thanks again, and God's blessings to all of you.